From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, opponents of hydrofracking are concerned about new natural gas pipelines. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on the possibility of a constitutional convention in 2017, and we'll take you to three counties in New York that are the latest to join Operation Lifesaver. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Hydrofracking has been banned in New York State for nearly a year now, but opponents of the natural gas extraction process have other concerns, including new pipelines. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Opponents of hydrofracking are now focusing on gas pipelines that conduct fracked gas from other states underneath New York. 30,000 people signed petitions against the doubling of the size of the Algonquin pipeline, also known as the AIM pipeline. The 21-inch wide gas conduit is located near the Indian Point nuclear power plant. The federal government has already approved expanding the pipeline to 42 inches wide. Assemblywoman Sandra Galiff, whose Westchester district includes both the nuclear plant and the pipeline, says the project is a potentially dangerous mistake.
Now, this isn't any nuclear plant, just any old nuclear plant. It's the one closest to the major metropolis area, New York City, and then one that was highlighted on September 11th when it appeared on Terrace Map.
Paul Blanche is a nuclear expert who has served as a consultant to many of the nuclear plants in the Northeast, including Indian Point. He says he's not against nuclear power or natural gas extraction, but he is concerned about the close proximity of the nuclear plant and the gas pipeline. Blanche says using the Freedom of Information laws, he obtained data from the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the risk study that they conducted, and what he saw concerns him. He says if the pipe ruptured and exploded, it would impact buildings up to 2 miles away. The Indian Point plan is half a mile away from the pipeline. He says the explosion could cause a power outage, which often happens in these instances.
Not being an alarmist, it could literally melt down these two plants. Fukushima did not melt down because of an earthquake or a tsunami. Fukushima melted down because it had no power. The exact same thing could happen here with a gas line explosion, and I'm not going to say that it's going to happen in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, but there is a probability.
Governor Cuomo also lives in Westchester, and he said he'd like to see Indian Point close. Assemblywoman Galiff, along with anti-fracking advocates and pipeline opponents, hope that will give Cuomo more impetus to order a state risk assessment through his own Department of Environmental Conservation. She says she's already met with some Cuomo staff members.
We want somebody that just can look at this and say whether it's safe or not.
Galiff says the state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman, has also expressed interest in looking into the matter. A spokesman for Cuomo says the governor is evaluating the group's request for further scrutiny. State permits for the pipeline have already been issued, but Cuomo's Department of Environmental Conservation has rescinded permission for projects in the past after public outcry, including the building of an oil-burning plant at the Port of Albany. Westchester residents aren't the only ones who are concerned about new or expanded gas pipelines. Ruth Foster lives in Rensselaer County, near the route of a proposed Northeast Energy pipeline. It would pass underneath New York from fracked wells in Pennsylvania for delivery to New England states. Foster says, ironically, the pipeline would be built along the Marcellus shale fields in the state's southern tier, where fracking has been forbidden by the Cuomo administration. But she worries that building the infrastructure to ship gas in the southern tier could make it easier for a future governor to change the state's ban on fracking.
They're going to have to feed the pipelines with frack gas for 50 years to come. And one concern is if they run out of frack gas in Pennsylvania, the pipeline will go through the fracking fields of New York State, so they might revisit fracking in this state again.
Cuomo administration officials say they don't have any plans to revisit their ban on fracking anytime soon. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Sat down with your old friend Jerry Benjamin, political scientist, runs the Benjamin Center, very renowned scholar in New York State. And of course, the issue for most of the program was the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, you know, this may make people's eyes water and their eyelids drop. But every so often, New Yorkers have to vote on whether we should have a constitutional convention or not. In the past, these conventions, in my mind, have been somewhat disgraceful. We spend an awful lot of money on them. The same political people who control the legislature, and we all know about that, control the Constitutional Convention. And obviously, they're not going to permit anything that hurts their ability to wield power. And then we get stuck with a huge bill. We don't want to have the Olympics here because it's too much. It costs too much. But the Constitutional Convention, everybody says, yeah. And this is where my fight with my very good friend, maybe my best friend, Jerry Benjamin, comes into play. He believes that since there's a possibility something good will come out of a constitutional convention, and since there is so many problems in government, which we all agree on, that you should have the constitutional convention and just hope that it'll turn out okay. To me, I don't want to waste the money unless there is some sense that something good and productive will come out of this. And I don't see the contemporary leaders in either house of the legislature allowing that to happen. But wait a second. Aren't the people who are in the constitutional convention different than the people who are sitting in the legislature? Yeah. I've heard all of that before. But as I've often said, everybody has a cousin Louie or a friend, and they run them for these offices, and then you get the same old, same old.
Most of our listeners know that the state of New York banned fracking, but more grassroots organizations rising up about the proposals for pipelines of frack gas going through parts of New York.
Well, look, this is something that really affects a lot of landowners and a lot of people. And they worry about things like spills and corruption of the pipelines. And I'm getting more mail on this than anything I've ever seen. And it is really just now becoming frontline stuff. Hey, if somebody wants to put a pipeline through my land, I'm not going to like it. I get it. I get that. Now, there's a big issue is where's this oil coming from? And where's it going to? If it doesn't really help the people of New York State and it's going off to a shipping point and it's coming from a place north of where people live, they don't see why that they should take the risk of having it. And I can certainly understand that.
Mayor Bill de Blasio held his first town hall of his term, Alan, this week. It was held on Wednesday and has been criticized for not having more face-to-face interaction with constituents, and many of his predecessors held them with some regularity.
Put yourself into these people's places, these politicians. Do you really want to expose yourself to the potential for someone from, well, the wacko nut fringe standing up in a meeting and starting to berate you and give you trouble? Look, we have freedom of information laws. We have all this open government. It's a great thing. It's a very important thing. And yet, quite often, the people who take advantage of it are not the rank and file people in a political constituency. They're one or two people who stand up and cause havoc. And then you say, if you're a politician, who needs this?
Does the Southern Tier need a casino, Alan? A plan to expand a casino in New York Southern Tier is a full resort casino won the endorsement of state gambling regulators this week. Tioga Downs was the only contender for a single casino license available in the region. One of the state's most economically challenged is a casino to fix.
First, the regulators said no. Now the regulators say yes. What's the intervening variable, as the political scientists say? It is the governor sending in what many people consider to be orders to those folks. Approve it. What does he lose? They want to build it. It's their money. He can say, I'm not leaving you out. And he goes for it. And they change their mind. Am I surprised? No. But of course, we now have this plethora of building casinos. And they're all over the place. They're Connecticut, they're New York, they're New Jersey. We already see the New Jersey casinos going down, or many of them anyway. And so one wonders whether throwing this fish to the seals and saying, go ahead and, you know, build anything you want, and I'll get some political credit for it, whether or not this is really a great thing, because it may be doomed to failure.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Following 13 dam collapses in South Carolina due to the severe weather last week, there's a call for passage of legislation to maintain and upgrade hazardous dams, including hundreds in New York State. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Heavy rains have saturated the Carolinas, a surge that's been dubbed a 1,000-year event. According to SC Educational TV, some 300 roads and 166 bridges across South Carolina were closed due to flooding. 18 dams in the state have breached or failed, as officials eye other dams nervously. Hudson Valley Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney says one high-hazard dam outside of Columbia had last been inspected in 2000, even though it was required to receive inspections every 3 years, according to Army Corps records. He's taking steps to tighten the rules.
We should not wait until it's too late. We should not wait for flooding like we're seeing now in South Carolina to take place for us to act.
More than 800 dams dot Maloney's home turf in the Hudson Valley. He is proposing legislation that would help fund routine dam maintenance, inspection, and rehabilitation in hopes of deflecting any disaster that may rival what happened down south.
My program would only focus grant dollars on the most critical publicly owned dams across the country, with two-thirds of the funds in my bill going to states with the highest number of high-hazard dams. In other words, we would put the resources where the greatest need exists. This would be a matching program so that 75% of the funds would be federal and 25% would be provided by the state or local communities. And it would provide in total $800 million in grants over the first 5 years.
Casey Dinges is Managing Director of Public Affairs, Membership, and Marketing for the American Society of Civil Engineers.
Well, 50 years ago, dams were built with the best engineering construction standards of the time. Scientific and engineering data have improved, and it is important to make an investment and modernize this crucial infrastructure. Furthermore, many dams are not expected to safely withstand current predictions regarding large floods and earthquake events. In addition, the number of high-hazard dams continues to increase as our population rises and there's greater development below dams. Many dams that, when built, were considered low-hazard are now classified as high-hazard dams because of additional development below dams.
New York State has 403 dams classified as high-hazard. A small earthquake that recently shook the area near the Gilboa Dam reminded Schoharie Valley officials and residents to be prepared for the unexpected. Gilboa and other system dams that affect the New York City watershed are under the watchful eye of the New York City Department of Environmental Protection's Bureau of Water Supply. The small shaker didn't affect the structure. Adam Bosch is DEP's Director of Public Affairs.
We have a very good idea on an almost real-time basis of what's going on.
In September, the Association of State Dam Safety Officials recognized the $138 million Gilboa Dam Reconstruction Project as National Rehabilitation Project of the Year.
I mean, it's the most prestigious dam award in the United States. It was just awarded that. So, you know, we've got obviously a very strong, for all intents and purposes, brand new dam up there at Gilboa that's well instrumented.
Mark Ogden with the Association of State Dam Safety Officials backs the congressman's proposed legislation.
In our December 2012 update of our report entitled The Cost of Rehabilitating Our Nation's Dams estimates the total cost of rehabilitating the nation's high-hazard potential dams is approximately $18.2 billion, $11.2 billion for publicly owned and $7 billion for privately owned. So the funding provided in Representative Maloney's bill will help to address this gap and resolve the most critical public safety needs.
During Hurricane Irene in Orange County, officials ordered evacuations of neighborhoods in the potential path of flooding below dams at the Warwick Reservoir and in the towns of Deer Park, Blooming Grove, and Tuxedo. Farther upstate, New York's Department of Environmental Conservation has looked into modifying several dams, including the Imperial Dam on the Saranac River, by adjusting heights of spillways and building fish ladders, among other measures. And a few older structures may come down. The Marcy Dam on Marcy Brook, a wooden structure erected during the logging era, was a popular stop for hikers and campers making their way to and from the Adirondack High Peaks. It was damaged in 2011 by Tropical Storm Irene. Deconstruction is expected to be completed by 2020.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
Environmental advocates are breathing a sigh of relief after an idea to store oil tanker cars in the Adirondack Park now looks like a non-starter. More from the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard.
In July, Ed Ellis, president and CEO of the Saratoga North Creek Railway, went before the Warren County Public Safety Committee to discuss his idea to store empty oil tanker cars in the central Adirondacks. The 30-mile rail line is owned by Warren County. At the time, Ellis addressed safety concerns related to the DOT 111 cars that are used to transport crude oil.
In terms of the amount of residue that's in them, there might be, after a while, after the film drips down in the bottom of the car, there might be a few gallons. And we do inspect them when they come in to make sure they're really empty.
How secure are they?
We're not storing them in towns. We're storing them up by the mine or sidings that are, so you'd have to hike in 2.5 miles to find one. And because we've made sure that they're empty before they go up there, I think that the danger level is virtually non-existent.
Adirondack Wild was one of a handful of organizations concerned about the plan and sent a letter to Governor Cuomo urging caution. Partner Dave Gibson told WAMC there were several unknowns.
You have an unspecified amount of oil in these cars. We don't know, based on what he told Warren County, where the cars would be inspected, who would inspect them, and how long the cars would remain on the tracks. So given all those uncertainties, this proposal or this action, because the company says they don't need any permission, poses a significant threat to human health and safety, and it's also a very severe eyesore and junkyard for old oil cars.
This week, it appeared the railroad was backing away from the plan. In a statement emailed to WAMC, Ellis said there was never an actual proposal to store the tank cars. He says, quote, "I simply notified Warren County that there was interest in storing tank cars and why it made sense that there would be interest. We have never received a single proposal to move in tank cars, and I simply wanted to let them know that if it came, we would be open to it, but it never came," unquote. Ellis said the storage of cars could provide a welcome revenue stream that could support the reopening of the line. The company hopes to move material from the Tahoe mine in Newcomb down to New York City. He says the railway is close to an agreement with all parties to do that. Peter Bauer, executive director of Protect the Adirondacks, said he was pleased the company appears to be looking at options other than storage.
All of the tracks that they had identified as possible storage locations were either a stone's throw from the Hudson River, the Boreas River, or Vandewacker Brook. Some of these rivers are some of the most beautiful stretches in the state. Some were along areas that are heavily used by the commercial rafting industry. I don't think anybody's expectation is you take a rafting trip through the Hudson Gorge and then you paddle out passing hundreds of dirty oil tanker cars.
The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation did not respond to a request for comment Thursday, but a statement published in the Albany Times-Union called the idea to store the oil cars concerning. The statement continues, quote, "We are happy to hear that the Saratoga and North Creek Railway is working to address the state and local communities' concerns and is close to a deal to prevent oil tank car storage in the Adirondacks, as we have been urging for the railway to do. We look forward to reviewing the railway's amended proposal," unquote. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Clinton, Franklin, and Essex counties are the latest in New York to join Operation Lifesaver, an effort by law enforcement agencies to use technology to speed search and rescue operations. Sheriff's departments from the three counties demonstrated the technology recently that they hope will save lives. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there and filed this report.
Operation Lifesaver uses FM radio technology. Someone with autism, Alzheimer's, or another condition wears an ankle or wristband with an embedded unique frequency. If they wander off, law enforcement can track them quickly. Clinton County Sheriff Dave Favreau calls it one of the most impactful programs he's ever seen.
Having responded to multiple cases of missing children with special needs and adults with special needs, and the fear and the panic in the eyes of the caregivers, the family and the loved ones wondering if they're going to be able to recover their person with special needs quickly enough before the elements set in, before medical conditions set in, or before they're taken advantage of. So this is an incredible moment to be able to provide this level of comfort and this level of excitement to people in our community that are quite often forgotten about, to be honest with you.
Franklin, Essex, and Clinton County are partnering for a tri-county rollout of Operation Lifesaver in the North Country. Devices have already been distributed to some families. Lindsay Baker Flora got a wristband for her autistic 11-year-old son, Jonah, about a month ago.
It means so much to us as a family to have this, because I never know if he's going to just run out of my house or run out of school, and now I know for sure they would actually be able to help me locate him. It just means so much to me.
You can't take it off, so if I get either lost or got taken away by a stranger, they will track this machine to my bracelet, and it can hear a beep if they get closer.
During a live demonstration, Sergeant Nicholas Leon took a wristband and left the area. Later, Sergeant William Dominey unfolded the directional antenna and described the system before leading a group on the search for his coworker.
I'm looking for the strongest signal. I was able to pick up that I have a ping that way. And we lost beeps, right? So I lost it here, I lost it here. That means he's straight ahead. I can see it from here. And there he is.
Sergeant Leon and the media who had accompanied him were located in less than 15 minutes, about a quarter mile from their starting point. The New York State Missing Persons Clearinghouse is based at the Division of Criminal Justice Services. Program manager Cindy Neff notes that the technology has been deployed across the state.
A total of 746 personal transmitters and the accompanying technology to track them have been distributed at no cost. The state purchased the technology with approximately $253,000 that we used from the Missing and Exploited Children Special Revenue Fund.
All but seven counties in the state are now using the technology. Those interested in participating should contact local sheriff's departments online.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1542. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.